Brothers, sisters, and friends. First of all, I want to thank the brothers and sisters of the Texas Ecclesias for putting on this fraternal gathering, this period of time for spiritual nourishment and hospitality. Not only is this a well-needed and necessary pause from the world, but a week of edification and fellowship, a gathering of a cross-section of the one body, a group of fellow travelers on the path which is leading to judgment and to the kingdom to be established here on the earth. My responsibility this afternoon is to keep you stimulated enough to induce a discussion on Ecclesiastes chapter 8. This is a difficult task, especially after eating a meal and sitting under a hot tabernacle. Please pay attention. I'm going to give some introductory remarks on Ecclesiastes chapter 8. I'll do a quick dissection of the verses and try to interpret what I think is the central points for us to ponder, and then present some thoughts for discussion. It has been suggested that the book of Ecclesiastes was not written by Solomon at all, but rather a person commissioned to write the words of the king. Of course, popular thought is that the king did not write the book. Many scholars of the Bible have attempted to discredit the inspiration of the entire Bible and have done so throughout the ages. So why not the books of Solomon? The same has been said about the prophecy of Isaiah. Many think that Isaiah did not write the prophecy because there are changes in the method and writing style of the narrative. I wouldn't think this phenomenon was too strange. Why? If you were to read a talk or recitation that I wrote 20 or 30 years ago, when I first was given the responsibility to write or exhort, you would probably see a difference in how I write now and the intent of what I write about. Of course, there could be some changes in time with the text from Solomon, while the focus of what Solomon wanted recorded later in his discoveries of wisdom. Another thing to ponder is that even if Solomon did not pen the words himself, he most assuredly had a scribe that would have been employed to write what the king wanted to have written. The intent of the king was to have the information available for him to reflect on in the future, as well as his thoughts and conclusions preserved for reference as part of his legacy. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 appears to be divided into three parts. The first, verses 1 through 5, appears to be a conclusion of a discussion that had taken in a previous time. It could also be a dialogue or a process of thought taking place in the king's mind and penned to show his thought process, like doing the math and doing the calculations on a piece of paper. Verse 1, who is as the wise, and who knows the meaning of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. Ah, now I get it. How do I feel when all of a sudden what you have been struggling for comes clear, and you finally understand? Your whole countenance can light up and glow, and you can become exuberant, and of course you want to tell everybody. Brother Sid commented yesterday that searching a matter takes time, but by zooming out of the subject and taking a look in a different way can help one finally get it, and it is the exhilaration of knowing the meaning that makes the face shine. Keep the king's words, because of the oath of God. When given the opportunity to have anything, Solomon requested wisdom. So the oath of Yahweh was fulfilled so that Solomon got the gift of wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 29. And God gave Solomon exceeding great wisdom and understanding and largeness of heart, even as the sands that are in the seashore. Verse 3. Do not be hasty to leave the presence nor take a stand in evil things, for he does whatever he pleases. You have a king that has been appointed by Yahweh and given wisdom. The king was sanctioned by Yahweh. Don't abandon him. Don't discredit him when you feel his decisions are not as you want, or that you think are right, are not right, or rather enjoy the cloak of security that he offers by his power and strength, especially when encouraged by and directed by Yahweh. Don't choose to abandon allegiance to the anointed king because you see or hear that he has put forth energy to try things that you would not be able to do yourself or even deem appropriate. Trust the king, as he will justly, through tried wisdom, do the right thing. As we know, the only one that did this totally, righteously, was Christ. Look at the next verses. Because the word of the king is that which hath power, and who may say to him, what are you doing? This thought may have occurred in relation to Solomon, but is inconceivable in relation to Christ. Finally, in this part, verse 5 presents a summation of the thoughts above. Verse 5, whoever keeps the command shall feel no evil, and a wise man's heart knows both time and judgment. It's tough when you get a cloud of dust coming in your throat. A wise man knows when and where to act. He not only does the right thing, but he does it at the right time. Not too harshly, and of course, not tardily. Look at the example that Christ used to teach his message. The foolish virgins waiting for the bridegroom tried to do the right thing, just as have the wise virgins, Matthew chapter 25, but they were not prepared, the unwise virgin, they were not prepared ahead of time, and then it was too late, and the door was shut upon them. How about Esther? She, by contrast, thought carefully as to the appropriate time and place to put her petition to the king, and of course we know that she was successful. The second part of this chapter starts with verse 6 and goes to 14. Here is the discussion of the time and energy spent thinking about justice and justification. Why are there contradictory outcomes in relation to justice when it is clear that the result should be different? Verse 6, for there is a proper time and procedure for every matter. This is a continuation of the thought process throughout Ecclesiastes. There is a time and purpose, a time and procedure, a time and appropriateness for everything, especially anything that is important. Verses 7 through 9 reflect on the justification of justice, the uncertainty of what and how one's life will end up or even end. There are no guarantees of the length or quality of life during our trial period. We were reminded about the trials that Job endured and the accusations of his friends. The accusations, however, were not the intent of his trials. It was the testing and proving of a man's righteousness. The outcome of our journey, our trial period, is what we do with that dash between our birthday and the day of our death. The book of record is open while the dash has no date after it. We have the opportunity to adjust the outcome. We have the obligation to identify and recognize that which needs to be changed and have this opportunity only until that record book is closed. At that time, we can no longer alter or change our individual outcomes. That will be made clear at our judgment. And this happens after the dash when we are called from the grave to judgment, or when the knock at the door is heard if Christ returns while we are alive. Verse 9. So all that I saw as I applied my mind to everything done under the sun, everything that was pondered was applied to everything that was done under the sun, while alive, while awake. Verses 10 through 14 deal with the negative outcome of evil. There is sometimes something else meaningless that occurs on earth. Righteous men who get what the wicked deserve, and wicked men who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. People saw the wicked buried. People were upset when the wicked did not have swift sentencing for crimes. Wicked live long and prosperous lives. This is what was identified through observation and what was interpreted through the complaints of the people. But the crux of the matter remained wrapped in the wisdom that their longevity and prosperity is only for a short time. They are without God in the world, and therefore not heirs to the promises. They have their reward now. Third part is verse 15 through 17. This presents the positive aspect of what this life is about. Whether what we have been given is a trial or a blessing does not matter. It's how we manage it, deal with it, or have assistance through the trial that will count. It was brought out in discussion yesterday that maybe riches, that which makes life living easy, could be a method to destroy the possessor, and that riches are really a trial. Verse 15, so I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and to drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his works all the days of his life God has given him under the sun. This is a summation and conclusion of the reality that is, in a sin-cursed world, there is much of human existence marked by relative futility. Since the righteous man cannot assume that he will automatically experience temporal prosperity and blessings on the earth, he should, at the very least, enjoy every day to its fullest as a gift from God. But it should be pointed out that the temporal enjoyment in this life does not preclude the faithful anticipation of the infinitely greater joy of the age to come. In fact, it may enhance the legitimate enjoyment that might be derived from this life. For the wise man will take that joy for what it is, a gift from God, the best that he can offer now, but he will not set his whole heart upon it and the only joy to be had. Verse 17. Then I looked at all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise one speaks of knowing, yet he shall not be able to find it. Solomon tried and found out that all is vanity. All is vexation in the negative aspect, unfruitful, except he found that some things are born of righteousness, and that becomes the responsibility not to be challenged like vanity and vexation. The whole discovery process was not done in one day. Rather, it took a lifetime. Ecclesiastes is a journal of what the king uncovered through trial and what he deduced through wisdom. The sum was that all things are vexation and a waste of time when not used for or dedicated to the honor and glory of Yahweh. Not everything is a benefit to man's righteous being. All things are God-given, but are to be used to enhance the life dedicated to righteousness. So prove all things. Hold fast to that which is good. Brothers and sisters, what is it that Solomon wanted us to understand? He deduced that everything can be vanity, a wisp of air, and a vexation to the very being of man. I want to say that this is true if not applied appropriately. Wisdom is only as good as how it is applied, how it is used, and how it is incorporated into our lives. We need to remind each other what vanity and what vexation to our righteous walk is. Moderation may not be enough. You may have to turn off the TV and not just cut down its use. You may have to try and read with someone else rather than by yourself. You can use the telephone or even the Skype program. We have been encouraged to visit to care for the fatherless and the widows. This may be done today in alternative ways that benefit all involved. Wisdom of the truth centers on steadfastness and righteous, spiritual righteousness. Think of what I can do, the way I can assist, or the way I fit into the one body. Solomon gave us a pattern and a process. Jesus encouraged us because we are to assist each other. Preparation is being made for us to reign as kings and priests. In order to be prepared, we need to understand that we are one. Brother Philip said yesterday that we cannot do it on our own, and we cannot do it alone. We can make our face change and shine when we are sharing the burdens of this life with those traversing that path towards the kingdom. We have been given what we have to use appropriately, as Christ explained in the parable of the talents. We have what we have to use, not pack away and save without usury. To be seeking more and striving for more is vanity and will be vexation of spirit. Enjoy what we have and use it to demonstrate honor and glory to Yahweh, because that is what we need to do, what we should want to do as we move Zionward.
Thank you, Brother Gary, for those opening remarks. We'll open this chapter up for discussion. Brother Aaron.
I'd like to thank our Brother Gary, who applied a lot of these verses to Christ. And there's also some practical applications, like in the first part of chapter 8, where it says, "Where the word of a king is, there is power, and who may say unto him, What doest thou? Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment." What Solomon's saying there is, don't openly question a person of power, whether a king or your boss, a judge. If they make a judgment or they tell you to do something, don't just openly question them, because you're probably not going to like the results of that. Also, don't go behind their back. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. Speak bad against his judgments. Just do them. The wise man knows that there's a time and a place to speak your mind. Don't just go for it and usurp someone's authority.
Brother Dan.
I would like also to thank Brother Gary for his thoughts and provoking us all to look at Ecclesiastes and what it was written for. Many times we read this just to get through it and get on to the next. You pick out a piece here and there that might apply to your life, but there's so much more in it. And actually, when Brother Gary was going through it, it sparked something in my mind about verse 14, where he says, there's a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. He said, this is also vanity. It clicked in my mind that there was a psalm written by Asaph about this very same thing when Asaph was at a very low period in his life. And we have to understand Asaph was going into the temple daily. And yet, when you start looking at Psalm 73 and realize this man of faith, it says, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. And his having struggles in his life with the ones who were wicked and yet were doing very, very well, and he couldn't really understand it. He says, there are no pangs in their death. Their strength is firm. They are not troubled as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore, pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. And he went on and on, and you can read it. But it wasn't until verse 17 where he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. And he drew the same conclusion that we see here in Ecclesiastes, that all of this was just for a passing moment. All of it was for vanity. And so often, as our brother Matt mentioned, I guess, in his talk to the, or little comment to the young people, sometimes the things in the world look really good. You wonder sometimes, how does the world prosper so well? And here we are forced, perhaps, in your mind, to come to high, forced to do the readings, forced to go to Sunday meeting and Wednesday night class. And if we really could pause and stop, and I know it's difficult when you're young, but to look at it like Asaph and look at it like Solomon did, truly the end is that when they pass, it is nothing but wind, it is nothing but air, nothing goes with them. I said to a brother a few days ago that I heard a saying one time that you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. And that's absolutely true. You can't take anything with you when we leave, so we should build up what would remain for standing before our judge at the last day. But there are many examples in the Bible of this very thing.
Brother Burroughs first, and then Brother David Somerville.
I'd like to kind of go back a little bit to the verses 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. I don't have the quote of the man with me, the name of the man, but there was a rabbi, and I read his thoughts on Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon, and I thought he had a great idea, because he likened them to the Proverbs to the outer court of the temple, Ecclesiastes to the inner court, and the Song of Solomon to the most holy. And I thought that was a very apt description, especially when, as you go through and you study these chapters. And when you think about the spiritual aspect of what's being said in the fifth and sixth verses, you know, he says, whoso keepeth the commandments shall feel no evil thing. And a wise man's heart discerneth time and judgment. And he said, the verse before, it describes the king. Well, who is the king? The king would be God. When you keep his commandments, you feel no evil thing. Because no matter what happens in this life, you understand the promises. You understand what's to come, and you can't be hurt by this life. And when you think about it, the wise man's heart, whose heart discerneth both time and judgment. I mean, that's something we've been commanded to do. And there's time and judgment. And a lot of times we call it the signs of the times. And we think about discerning the signs of the times for our time. We're focused on our time when we think of the signs of the times. But it's signs of the time. And he says here, both time and judgment. Well, Brother Jim gave a lecture last night, a very, very good lecture. And he showed us the signs and the time. But it wasn't our time. It was based on the 17th chapter of Revelation. We saw the corruption of the truth. We saw the corruption of the scriptures coming forth from the apostasy. Well, those are signs, and those are times. Those are things that we need to discern. In the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, a lot of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos. I mean, there's a lot of prophets in the Bible. These are signs, and they're times. And it's our duty to discern and understand what God is trying to teach us. It's not just our local signs of the times. So when we think about Ecclesiastes, you know, it's right next to that most holy. It's right there with a lot of information. And yes, a lot of it is practical information, but a lot of it is very much in the spirit. There are things that God is trying to teach us in here. And just like the prophets, it's our duty to discern those signs, that time and that judgment.
Brother David Somerville's next.
Brother Sid, in this morning's comments, talked about the 28th verse of the 7th chapter and suggested that the one man among a thousand was Christ. And I agree with him, and I think it's here in the first verse, who is as the wise man? And I think this wise man is Christ. And who knoweth the interpretation of things? Solomon was a very wise person, and he used his wisdom for a lot of folly and foolishness. He built things, and then he said, well, you know, what good is it? It's all vanity. But this time, he doesn't say it's vanity. A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine. And like Brother Gary brought out, that when we finally figure something out, you know, we get it makes sense to us, and we want to tell other people about it. And in the second verse, he says, there, I counsel thee to keep the king's commandments in regards to the oath of God. So I think that Solomon here is now understanding the interpretation of all. I mean, he built the temple. He did all the sacrifices. He had all these things. But it was all for show at the beginning. But I think now here at the end of his life, he realizes that these sacrifices pointed forward to this wise man that was coming. And this realization of his wisdom is what made his face to shine.
Brother Lynn Osborne, did you have a comment? No? Maybe that was Brother Philip right beside you, maybe. Did you have one, Brother Philip? Back up here, Jesse. I don't have anybody else. I picked you because there wasn't anybody else.
maybe I could start by thanking Brother Gary for again developing our thoughts along these words of inspiration. And actually, that was one of the things that struck me in some of the other talks that people have made reference to. Was it Solomon or was it someone else? And I think Brother Gary said he'd read something about it could have been Solomon's servant. The bottom line is that we're not only looking at the experiences of Solomon, we're looking at the experiences of Solomon which are recorded under inspiration. So we're looking at the inspired and infallible word of the living God. We're not just looking at a mortal man's perspective, to use Brother Sid's reference, of life and death. We're looking at God's perspective of all these things, and they're recorded here for a purpose. And I think as I've been considering these things through the week, to me it looked like, to begin with, a macro view of everything. You know, the things which are just way beyond man's control, you know, the glorious things of creation. You know, Brother Thomas opened up Elpis Israel, revolving upon his own axis and describing an ample circuit through the boundless fields of space. is a planet bearing upon its surface a population of over 1,000 million, it's greater than that now, subject to sin, disease, and death. Brother Thomas opens that up. It's a dramatic opening to the hope of Israel, where he looked at everything. He looked at the orb. He saw it teeming with life, teeming with people, and yet they were subject to sin, disease, and death. And he observed these things as if he was out in the universe, looking back and looking down on the earth. And there it was, all going on, the wonderful parts of nature. But as you sort of like used Brother Sid's phrase again, as you zoomed in on it, you observed its beauty like a diamond in the sky, Brother Thomas described it up. But when you looked at it, it was subject to sin, disease, and death. And the more you look at it, you see sometimes what appears to man to be inequitable things, the just and the unjust, the wicked, the righteous, the oppressions, the madness, the folly. What does it mean? What is all this? The vanity of life is apparent. And that's where Brother Thomas starts his second section, where he says the necessity of a revelation. The necessity of a revelation. And that's, I think, what we've got here in Ecclesiastes. We don't have to go through all the experimental process that Solomon did. Yahweh has recorded these things for us so that we can learn from them. And I was struck in this particular chapter that Brother Gary's drawn our attention to. I think it's about the fourth time in the Ecclesiastes that we have this reference to eating and drinking and being merry in verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. Actually, Rotherham in the Emphasized Bible renders the word merry as gladness. You know, we might get the wrong impression about being merry, but we might think about it as a frivolous thing, perhaps even stimulated by an intoxicant. But basically what we are told is to be glad. And it seems to me that the issues that Solomon, under inspiration, is developing is the enjoyment in the simple things of life and the acceptance of what God has set in motion. I think that the Ecclesiastes, it's not a depressing book. We should see it as a very positive book teaching us these things. And I think what we are getting is the sense we're not going to go through life looking for enjoyment. If we set out in life looking for pleasure, looking for enjoyment, looking for fun, we're not going to find it. And Solomon is telling us that in whatever avenue of life, he seems to be now in a micro sort of aspect, looking at the various things, we're not going to find pleasure. We're not going to find enjoyment, but enjoyment, pleasure, would flood in upon us and saturate us if we are putting God in our lives. If we are leaving God out of our lives and we're looking for enjoyment, we'll never find it. If we are accepting the gladness which God gives us, then it will be an inevitable consequence. Brother Fred quoted Brother Grocott this morning, and I happen to think of also Brother Grocott's words, you know, that I think it was the last filler before he died. I can't remember it verbatim, but it's something like, life is not sad if the life has been lived wholly unto God. It's a bit more than that. And he makes reference to the fact, you know, that we will be reunited with the loveliest, choicest characters of all ages in the kingdom. So when we look back at Solomon's experiences, we can take, and this is really an exhortation to young people, because the world is their oyster to a young brother or sister. Well, this is what Solomon's telling us. You know, don't look at the world as an oyster. You look at the world as your enemy. Look at serving God as the glorious pearl of great price, and then happiness and pleasure will inevitably follow.
Brother Pat, and then Brother Burrell. Okay, Brother Burrell, you're up.
Thank you, Brother Pat. Just to kind of go along with what Brother Philip was saying, you know, he made the comment to you know, look at life and enjoy what you're giving. We know Solomon in the 11th verse says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is set in them to do evil. You know, brothers and sisters, when God executes that sentence, there are usually righteous people in the receiving end of that execution. You know, if you think about AD 70, you know, they were given a sign and they were told to flee when they saw that sign. There were righteous people. Brother Roberts, in 1865, wrote that the War of 1812, the cholera epidemic of 1832, and the Civil War was a judgment against the United States. You know, we don't think of those being judgments. You know, most of us don't even know about the cholera epidemic and barely know what the War of 1812 was. So, you know, but they were judgments against, Brother Roberts honestly felt that they were judgments against the United States. Well, there was brethren there. I mean, there were brethren around in those times, especially during the Civil War, and some of them suffered and some of them didn't. But as Brother Philip was saying, if God was in their heart and God was on their mind, they weren't really suffering. They knew the hope. They knew what they were. They knew the end. And you know, we often say that God knows the end from the beginning. But so do we. I mean, we know the end. We know what's going to happen. You know, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that God's going to set up a kingdom upon the earth, and the elect are going to be glorified. There's no doubt. So we do know the end. You know, at least for us, that's the end. So, you know, when the judgments come, when the sentence is executed against the evil work, you know, if our heart is not set to do evil, if our heart is set to do righteousness, even though it's being executed, it's really not going to be a great bother to us. It'll be something we notice, I'm sure, but it's not something that's going to have that much of an effect. If you lose your house and your lands, as Brother Gordon was pointing out in his talk, you know, you can't take it with you anyway, so if you lose it, it's no loss. You know, but you do have the kingdom. If you lose your place in the kingdom, that will be the loss.
There's about 5 minutes left. Brother Pat and then Brother Aaron in the back to finish up.
I'll split it with you, Aaron. Okay, I was thinking some quick thoughts here. Actually, Burl helped me along here. The thing about things not being executed speedily, we have an example of that in Scripture. We have it during David's time when Joab went killing Abner and a few other people. And David said during that time that these sons of Zeruiah, which Joab was of, were too strong for him. But then later on, after the death of David, Joab was taken care of by Solomon. So that was one of where the sentence isn't executed speedily. And he was set on his heart on doing evil all that time. Still, judgment happened to him later. So that the other one was, he who finds his life shall lose it. He who loses his life for my sake shall find it, is what Jesus says. Now, when you read that verse, you say, wait a minute. I want to do these things. You want me to put that aside? No, well, let's put it this way. If you put your trust in the Lord and don't lean to your own understanding, but acknowledge Him in all ways that He would direct your paths, then you are putting Him in control of your life. And He will direct your steps. And you're in that point losing your life one way. You know, it's called like the crucifixion of the flesh, that way, putting yourself that way. But the joy at the end of it is that God shows you something you thought you didn't like, that you ended up seeing the benefit from it. And that we find that out all the time on that. I guess I better leave the rest to Aaron, because if I don't, there's not going to be much time left. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them.
Just to go off of Brother Burrell's previous comments, obviously you don't want to question God. You know, God is the king of all the universe, but in this chapter, I believe that the king here is not God. It's a foolish or even a wicked king that is making commandments that are perhaps foolish. And the wise man understands that he should hold his tongue. In verse 9, it says, "There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt, and so I saw the wicked buried." The wise man knows and understands that eventually the rulers of this world, the authorities, those people in power are eventually going to die. Their wickedness will not stand forever, and they'll all go into the ground. So restrain yourself, don't question authority, and don't commit evil behind authority's back.
Brother Freddie, I may have overlooked you. Did you have a comment? Okay. All right. I looked out this way, but I didn't catch that corner. So, all right, well, then we'll close this afternoon's study class.